his friends. This year should be a special schuss for Avi Marini Marazi Sheikh Lu Nishmas Marasasta Ras Pshmuel and Nishmas Rif David Ben Pshmuel, the schuss Pshmuel Ben Yamin Ben Tishna Rachalaya and David Shukwala Ben Rachel. And we are going to be discussing the inyan of Megillas Esther based on a talk given by Rav Soloveitchik in 1969. Megillas Esther begins with the phrase Vayihi bimei Achashverosh. It wasn't the day of Achashverosh. Vayihi bimei looks apparently to fix the time of an event and answer when it happened. But the Vayihi bimei Achashverosh also explains, it tells us why did that event occur. So the Vayihi bimei Achashverosh not only says when the event occurred, but it's also an etiology, it's an explanation of the background, the causes, why these events occurred. The Megillah tells us about paradoxically rational events, which are both tragic and comical. There's a king, he apparently kills his beloved, beautiful queen at the suggestion upon the advice of his friend Haman. Memuchan, Chazal say Haman's Memuchan is Haman. And later on he executes Haman upon the request and complaint of his beautiful queen Esther. So it's funny and it's sad, it's tragic and it's comical. It's a king who is really not such a stable guy, signs a decree to exterminate an entire people about who nothing knew nothing about, and later he denies knowledge of the entire incident after Esther complains to him. The story tells us about a commonwealth, an empire of many nations, many races, spoke a variety of language, practiced many cults, observed an enormous amount of rituals, and suddenly decided to exterminate an entire race because they had different laws. Isn't that crazy? And everybody else. How is it possible that not a single voice was raised in protest or in despair? Apparently Achashverosh tolerated demonstrations. If he hadn't tolerated public demonstrations, he wouldn't have allowed Mordechai to wrap himself in sackcloth and cry in a loud voice in front of the palace. Anybody could parade in front of the king's gates, in front of the palatial grounds. They couldn't enter, it says, with torn clothes, but they can parade in front of the palace. No one interfered. They didn't bring any of the troops in. They didn't bring the soldiers in. They didn't bring the police in. Yet nobody else joined Mordechai. If you read the Megillah carefully, you'll notice that Mordechai was the only individual who cried with a bitter and loud voice. Neither Gentile nor Jew, neither friend nor stranger joined Mordechai when he protested against the decree of genocide. It says, Vayir Shushan Navocha. Navocha doesn't mean mourning, it means perplexed, confused. The city of Shushan was confused. What happened? Apparently Jews didn't believe. The Jews refused to face reality, just as many of the Jews in the 40s didn't believe that the Nazis would exterminate them. The story is puzzling because of another coincidence. A short time before the decree was issued, the entire population of Shushan is invited to a 7-day feast on the grounds of the royal palace. The pasuk says, "L'cholam nimtzim b'Shushan Abira," that the king made a feast for all the people who were present in Shushan. He invited everybody, Jew, Gentile, no discrimination. "L'chol ha'am nimtzim b'Shushan Abira." Not only people who resided in Shushan were invited, even the people who were visiting, everyone was invited. Of course, they were all invited to the feast and banquet. They fraternized, Jew and non-Jew. Chazal described, they toasted each other, shook each other's hands, hugged each other, get a little drunk. And when you get drunk, usually your true feelings come out, but no anti-Semitism came out. Suddenly, just a short time later, Achar Advari Ma'ila, after this feast was completed, a ruthless, inhuman edict was issued and sent hastily with the couriers of the king to all parts of the commonwealth, Lahashmid, Laharog, Ulaavid, Eskola Yehudim, to destroy, to slay, to cause all the Jews to perish. All Jews, both old and young, little children and women, were to be murdered on one day. B'yoyim Echad. How is it possible that the same people, just a few days ago, they drank together, they feasted together, they ate together, and suddenly turn into enemies and fiends? What's more amazing, The runners went forth in haste, and the decree was given in Shushan. And the king and Haman sat down to drink, and the city of Shushan was perplexed. It's a remarkable pasuk. The pasuk portrays the mentality, the reaction, and the response of people in Shushan, as well as the response and reaction of Ahasuerush and Haman to this edict. The king and Haman celebrate their recent victory by feasting on wine. What do they celebrate? Nobody knew what was going to happen. Ahasuerush apparently had no concept of what he had just signed, what Haman wanted him to do. He had no idea that hundreds of thousands of Jews, old and young, children and infants, mothers and fathers, would perish for no reason under the sun. He was just feasting with Haman. V'amelech v'aman yashvu l'shtos. It's astounding. You would think that he would brood. You're not sure. The pasuk says, no, yashvu l'shtos. Didn't matter. They took a drink. Are these questions relevant only to the understanding of antiquity, of an episode of something which happened 2,500 years ago or now? A similar episode took place in Europe in the 30s and 40s. The same questions can be repeated almost verbatim. The German people in the commonly accepted terminology are civilized people who greatly contributed to what we call Western civilization, Western culture. Take the German contribution to music. There'd be no music if not for the German contribution. At almost every concert and every symphony hall, they offer works of German composers: Bach, Haydn, Beethoven, Mozart, Wagner. This is true not only of music, but the other disciplines as well. Without the German contribution to modern philosophy, there wouldn't be much modern philosophy. With regard to science, though many people have also contributed, the German contribution is very considerable. How is it possible that the German people in the Western world could witness not just the signing and issuance of an edict and decree, as happened in the time of Ahasuerush, but the actual extermination of 6 million Jews in crematoriums and gas chambers without uttering a single word of protest or condemnation? How is it possible that a man like Roosevelt, who apparently didn't seem like he was a bigot, he was liberal, and finally helped the free world to destroy Hitler, didn't move his little finger to help the victims of Majdanek, Auschwitz, Treblinka, Buchenwald? On the contrary, Roosevelt asked Dr. Stephen Wise to suppress the story about the extermination of the Jews in the various crematoria and not to disclose it to the press. He was afraid that the Jews would pressure the government in Washington to take action in order to save the innocent victims, the babies, little children, and old women. When the suggestion was made that the American Air Force bomb Majdanek and Auschwitz, Roosevelt vetoed it after consulting with Eisenhower. The reason for vetoing or rejecting that request, which had been made not only by the Jewish community, but by many senators and congressmen as well, was a simple one. Namely, that Majdanek and Auschwitz weren't military objectives, and if the American Air Force would drop bombs on Majdanek and Auschwitz, it would be tantamount to the bombardment of civilian installations. This response is both inane and mean. No one uttered a single word of protest. There were many liberals in the world. Gandhi was still alive. Schweitzer was still alive. And nobody raised a single word of protest. What about the Jews of America? Vayir Shushan Navocha. We too were perplexed. We too didn't believe because we didn't want to believe. Did we rend our clothes? Did we cry bitter and loud cries as Mordechai did? Vayir Shushan Navocha. The Western world was confused. Many didn't care, and the few who did care didn't believe. In the meantime, 6 million Jews were exterminated. How is this possible? There's only one answer to the problem we raise, both vis-a-vis the events which occurred in the time of Ahasuerush and the problem raised vis-a-vis our own behavior, in particular the behavior of the Western world, which could have saved so many hundreds of thousands of Jews. The answer is to be found in the intrinsic dichotomy of man, his inner contradiction, his inner incommensurability, in the mysterious world which Chazal has singled out, namely the word Vayitzer with two yuds. Vayitzer Hashem Elokim es Adam Ofrim en Adam. One yud is this word, one yud. They're two men. They're two human ontologies. Man's both an angel and a satan. Man can be merciful, he can be cruel. Refinement and vulgarity, considerateness and ruthlessness abide in man side by side. From the time Satan takes over, whether Satan appears in the guise of Haman or in the guise of a liberal who simply doesn't care or finds an excuse for his lack of concerns, irrelevant. Yehadus believes that there's evil in man, which may erupt unexpectedly without any advance notice. Amalek, according to Chachamei HaKabbalah, don't respect a race, an ethnic group, or some Bedouin tribe. Amalek is man himself. Amalek abides in every one of us, like we see in so many Svarim. He abides in me, abides in you, ready to leap forward and to swoop down upon man who was created in the image of God. Man, prophet, man, benefactor, merciful man, can be defeated easily by a Malik which abides within man, within every one of us. If you ask me, what's the main concern of Yahadus pertaining to man? What's the basic philosophical anthropology of Yahadus? Yahadus wants man to be satisfied with being what he is meant to be by his Creator, namely to be man, to be not less or more than man. If he's less than man, he's a beast. If he's more than man, he's bound to wake up and find himself in the embrace of Satan. In fact, the second alternative, that man may choose to be more than he is actually the main problem facing modern man. There is no possibility for modern man to descend from the cultural heights which he has scaled and conquered into the jungle or cave. The danger is the reverse, that he may overreach himself and try to mount greater heights, more challenging peaks, and by doing so lose his humanity. On his journey to the moon, to some fixed star, man may change his identity, and when he returns from the journey, he will return in the guise of Sutton. When man ventures to achieve vastness, when all boundaries are erased, all stop signs are removed, he can turn into Sutton. That's why the central virtue in Yahadus is anava, it's humility. Humility is self-limitation, being able to give up and withdraw at a time when conquest is in sight and aggression is rewarded. Yahadus believe that the human being is fascinated by two visions. Two goals attract his attention and stimulate his fantasy. In the quest for either of these two goals, man becomes oblivious to the fact that he's a finite being, a mortal being, a frail being, and a weak being. Man becomes oblivious to his finiteness, to his limitedness, and attempts to gain infinity. Man's first quest is that for beauty or pleasure, for unlimited enjoyment of life, the pursuit of happiness. Happiness means the unlimited enjoyment of life, what the Greeks called hedon, like hedonism. The second quest is for power and authority. When man is out to achieve power, authority, to become ruler, his ambition's unlimited. We see both in the Chumash. The Nachash says, Ki yodei Elokim, ki biyom achalchem imenu v'nifkachu einechem v'yisim ke Elokim yodei tova idiyat tova ra. Because Hashem knows that after eating from the tree, your eyes will be opened up, and you shall, as the Almighty Himself, be able to discriminate between good and evil. That means that the urge to sin is simply part of the human urge for absolute power and authority. Man wishes to legislate his own laws. He doesn't want to accept the laws which were given to him by Hashem. He wants to be the legislator of the law, and if he doesn't like the law that Hashem made, he can reject it. He makes his own rules. He's going to define his own moral code. On the other hand, the Pasuk also tells us that Chava was fascinated by the loveliness of the tree. It was a beautiful tree. Enjoyment, pleasure, aesthetic fulfillment. Vatera isha ki tova etz lamaychal v'chitavu leinayim v'nechmed etz lahaskil. The woman saw that the tree was tasteful, appetizing to the eye, and pleasing to the intellect. In a word, man is confronted by two quests. The quest for enjoyment, for aesthetic fulfillment, and the quest for authority and power to rule, command, and enslave. The Torah has not only formulated these two quests on the part of man, but has also described two generations which portray these two quests. The Torah tells about the Dor HaMabul and the Dor HaFlaga. V'rosh HaBashamayim, the apex will reach the heaven. Dor HaMabul, that's the orgiastic man, the man of pleasure. They wanted to live a life of hedonism, uninterrupted engagement in the aesthetic, orgiastic experience. They rejected all laws, all norms. Sometimes, when I read the story of the Mabul, I forget it was written so many years ago by Moshe. I can almost believe I'm reading an article in a current periodical about the new generation which wants freedom, rejects all authority, and wishes to legislate their own code of behavior. That was the Dor HaMabul, ki hishchis kol basar, flesh. And then there's the Dor HaFlaga. That doesn't represent orgiastic man. It's not about just about pleasure. Dor HaFlaga's authoritarian man. He wants to rule not only the earth but the heavens as well. The Dor HaFlaga wasn't addicted to pleasure. They were addicted to power. The Dor HaFlaga also tried to industrialize. The whole construction of the tower represented industrialization. their society enslaved the individual, not to other individuals, but to the state, to the collective, to the group. They were disciplined, unlike the Dora Mabel, who weren't disciplined, since orgiastic man. Never disciplined. The Dora Flugel were disciplined and well organized. They had a strict political code. They said, let's make a brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had a brick for stone and lime for mortar. Let's build a tower. The Communist Party, the whole ideology of Marxism, the way it was interpreted by Lenin and Mao Tse-Tung, could not have found a better description or portrayal than these two psukim in the Chumash. If you ask me whether I could simply portray the great confrontation between the West and East in biblical terms, I would say it's the confrontation between the Dora Mabel and Dora Flugga. The West is about pleasure. Mabel, they just want to buy, especially today, just acquire more and more and more. More features, more luxuries, more cars, more and more and more. The East is like the Dora Flugga, the communist atheist society, is committed to the production of heavy machinery and to the expansion of its empire, like we see with China and North Korea. There's one feature common to both the Dora Mabel and Dora Flugga. Both societies want to be more than man. They want to be creators. V'yisim kelokim yodea tov v'ra. You should be like the Almighty Himself, be able to discriminate between good and evil. You decide what's right and what's wrong. This is what happened in Germany in the 30s. Soloveitchik tells that he was in Germany at that time and he witnessed the transformation. What was Germany doing during the late 20s and early 30s? An orgiastic society, seeking pleasure and enjoyment. The flesh ruled and determined human aspirations and policies. It was an overindulgent, permissive, hedon, drunk, flesh-intoxicated society. And that society not only tolerated but promoted the dominion of evil, tyranny, and madness. So-called freedom movements, which reject all norms, all laws, and every semblance of regulated self-limiting life, and which preach boundless liberty and unlimited freedom from all authority, may precipitate something monstrous and something wicked. Mamish bayamim ahem bazman hazeh. How apropos. The same happened in the time of Ahasuerus. The Megillah didn't spare any words. And then obviously we know afterwards Germany turned into a power-hungry society. So the same Mahalach from the Mabel to the Aflaga. The Megillah hasn't spared any words in vividly portraying the absurd, reprehensible addiction of the king, his princes, courtiers, and servants to lascivious pleasures, the incessant pursuit of an ever-fleeing satisfaction, the habits of a society which heaps up vast riches, women. That's the Megillah. It's part of Kisvei HaKodesh. So why then was it necessary to perpetuate the names of the harem keepers, Shashgaz and Hegai? Why is it important that we remember the names of the keepers of the harems of virgins and that of the concubines? Why did the Megillah mention the brand of cosmetics used by the king's concubines? 6 months with one oil and 6 months with another oil. Why is this so important? Why does the Megillah tell us of the lewd, foul habits of the king? The Torah revealed so little about Avram's youth, even though it seemingly would have been of great importance to us. Similarly, the Torah didn't go into detail about Moshe's life. It felt that whatever happened to Moshe is Moshe's private affair. Moshe is only important as long as his life had an impact on the covenantal community. Yet the Torah tells us in minute detail about the various foul habits of Ahasuerus and his princes. The Torah, which reported the most important events with a minimum of words, becomes suddenly loquacious, telling us about the king's wives and royal banquets and the generous light of the life of the royal court. Why is this? The answer is simple. The Torah teaches us that only in such an environment is the rise of Haman possible. Only people who care about nothing but pleasure can tolerate a demagogue, tyrant, and madman. Only people addicted to the beautiful and pleasant, only people addicted to art, music, and painting can stand by and watch smoke rising to heaven from the chimneys of Majdanek and Auschwitz. Let me give you an example. The person responsible for the extermination of the Jewish community in Vilna was General Weiss. Weiss was an accomplished musician who specialized in the W-E-I-S-Z. He specialized in the works of Chopin and Mozart. He could play the piano beautifully with his left hand. The Nazis first exterminated the Jewish babies and infants of Vilna. As the Egyptians of old, the Nazis collected all the Jewish babies in Vilna. They lined them up in front of Weiss in the yard of the Gestapo offices. With his left hand, he played the works of Mozart. At the same time, he held a revolver in his right hand and shot the babies one at a time. It was a very strange combination: music, bloodshed, and murder. There was no contradiction. If man is addicted to beauty only, if beauty is the final goal of man, then any crime is possible. That's what the Megillah means by the phrase, Vayhi Achashverosh. You want to know why all of this nonsense occurred, this bloody nonsense? Because Achashverosh was king. His society was addicted to pleasure. It was an orgiastic society, an artistically minded society, conscious of the arts, music, and beauty. It was pleasure addicted, beauty addicted, and therefore capable of tolerating genocide and murder of any kind. By Hibi Me'achashverosh, the Megillah gives us the background. It portrays the society of the princes to allow us to understand what kind of degenerate society it was. The Megillah tells us exactly what these people desired and what their aspirations were. It's no wonder that Vacharet Vrei Me'eli Gidala Melech Achashverosh is Haman ben Amdasa. No wonder that Haman could ascend to power in that society. That's exactly what happened in Germany in 32 and 33. Why should the pleasure-loving society lead to political tyranny and the loss of moral conscience? The answer can be found in another pasuk. Vayomer Shvi Ketov Lev HaMelech B'Yayin. Amar Lahavi Es Vashti HaMalka L'fnei HaMelech B'Keser Malchus L'Haris HaAmin V'Aser M'Siyofa Ketov Es Mari. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded the seven chamberlains to bring Vashti the queen before him with the crown of royalty to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look upon. The moral conscience is inevitably lost whenever an individual submerges in the crowd, when public opinion is accepted as the highest guide and as the highest criteria, and whenever people look for consensus. When the king and the princes become intoxicated after feasting and drinking, then morality, decency, indeed humanity itself disappears. Orgiastic man forfeits his individuality when he disappears in the crowd, and he is prone to disappear and submerge in the crowd completely. Let me just describe this and compare it with principles of Yahadus. The concept of a crowd has long been the object of psychological and sociological studies. What's been proven can be formulated in a few sentences. First, the crowd is not just an aggregate of individuals, a loosely organized collective. It's more than that. The crowd is an entirely new ego, a separate identity which is totally different than its component parts. In what respect is the crowd individuality unique and different from its separate individual members? The answer is as follows. The crowd is emotionally excitable. Its emotional dynamics increase and gain intensity, power, and lust. The crowd is easily aroused into action, and at such times its intellectual and rational capacity is considerably reduced. Therefore, the crowd is easy prey for tyrants, demagogues, and false prophets. The collective composite of individuals is an overgrown baby, ready at the same time to cry and laugh hysterically, to rejoice and despair. At such times it's impossible for the crowd to understand the nature of its own actions. Indeed, it would feel completely perplexed and embarrassed if called upon to account rationally for its performance. We Jews know from experience what an inflamed, roused, and motley crowd of fanatics can accomplish. The massacres perpetrated by the mobs of the Crusaders in the 11th and 12th centuries by Khmelnytsky, in the 17th century by Nazi Germany, in the Hitler era, were each partly attributable to the ruthlessness of an excited mob, and for its lack of resistance to the persuasive words of charlatans and wicked, bloodthirsty demagogues. At times, the Christian church has tried to use the gullibility of the crowd for constructive purposes, for religious revival and awakenings, for arousing bravery or valor on the field of battle. However, over the period of many centuries, the crowd has been a vehicle for vulgar, crude, cruel, and inhumane emotions, rather than for noble, gentle feeling and refined sentiments. In Megillas Esther, we come across the aroused, drunk crowd, which casts off human shame and dignity and begins to act like a herd of cattle at mating season. Megillah tells us so beautiful, and then the seventh day when the king was merry, the seven chamberlains were commanded to bring Vashti before the king with the crown of royalty to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look upon. This is the result of the immorality of the crowd. Again, the transition from inflamed passions and intoxication, from promiscuity and shamelessness to cruelty and ruthlessness is quite natural. Vashti was executed because she refused to degrade herself. We can thus understand Yehadis. Yehadis never taken advantage of the emotional instability and excitability of the crowd. Yehadis hates an aroused mob and rejects the notion of a crowd electrified under the hypnosis of even a charismatic leader. The Chumash speaks with disdain and utter contempt of the inflated mob. For instance, by the Egel Azav, they rose to make merry, and that's big Averis. By the Chedem Araglim, Vayikalu al Moshe v'al Aharon, the two great disasters during the 40-year sojourn in the Midbar, which actually changed the destiny of the Jewish people, were due to the excitability, gullibility, and emotional instability of the crowd. The chet of the Egel Azov was a result of an absurd irrational fear. The crowd didn't know where Moshe disappeared to, and they were thus exploited by a few spellbinders. Similarly, by the sin of Meraglim, the Pasuk writes, Vayivku Ha'am, and the crowd cried. Whenever the Pasuk speaks of Ha'am, it means the crowd. The sin of the Meraglim was the consequence of the irrational black despair which gripped the masses. What about Yehadis? Does Yehadis actually utilize the crowd in order to make it commit itself to Hashem? Or does Yehadis deal solely with the individual? It seems that Hashem deals with the individual, not with the crowd. Even though the first Matan Torah occurred in the presence of the entire community, and the people's consent of Nasa and Nishma was indispensable, yet once they sanctioned the covenant, Hashem told Moshe, Lechem or lehem shuvu lechem lo alechem, v'atem po amodi modi. Tell the people to return to their homes, and you, Moshe, remain with me. Hashem doesn't address himself to the crowd, he speaks to the individual. His relationship is personal. Hashem prefers the rendezvous with the yachid. It's hard to teach a crowd. The smaller the class, the more the teacher will accomplish. On the other hand, when you address yourself to emotional man, the opposite is true. The larger the crowd, the easier it is for the speaker to put across his message when you're playing on their emotions. The encounter with the individual conveys information, instructs, trains, redeems, hallows the mind. The revelation to the crowd elicits mainly an uncritical emotional response, arouses the human heart but has little to offer the mind. Yehadus knows nothing about revivalism. You can't bring anybody closer to Yehadus by having them participate in a nice ceremony. Yehadus rejects ceremonialism. How much ceremonialism do we have in Yehadus? Tefillah is not a ceremony. It's not even a service in the colloquial sense of the word. Tefillah is derived from the word palel, which means to think, to judge, to evaluate. The tzibur consists of a mere 10 people. Yehadus as a teacher, as a Torah, which desires to enlighten, inform, and to train, prefers dealing with individuals and not with a crowd. The question arises, what course of conduct should an individual pursue if he lives in the time of Achashverosh, in an age of unlimited human ambition, human aggression, and human self-transcendence, which is primarily motivated by the attainment of either beauty, authority, rule, or complete control over the environment? How should an individual, who was a contemporary of Achashverosh, Meotzi Tang, the Dor Mabul and Dor Afluga combined act? What's his duty? This is the major problem confronting the contemporary Jewish religious community. After all, we reject both approaches. We reject hedonistic man. We also don't like authoritarian man. We believe in equality. Man is limited, can't transcend himself, and that if he will succeed in transcending himself, he might perish. After the Megillah portrayed a permissive, hedonistic, pleasure-conscious society, and after it portrayed the tyranny of Haman, the idolization of man, that everybody has to bow down to Haman, the Megillah then portrays Esther and Mordechai. And that's the contrast. What did Mordechai do? It says that Esther didn't reveal her ancestry since Mordechai instructed her to remain silent. Every day Mordechai would walk in front of the court of the harem to find out about Esther's well-being and what would become of her. And then it says, in those days, while Mordechai was sitting at the king's gate, and Mordechai learned about what had been done. These are just a conglomeration of fragments. Prima facie, we don't understand Mordechai. What was the reason for Mordechai's inseparability from Esther? And every day during Esther's stay in the court of the royal house, Mordechai walked past that house. The phrase of b'chol yom v'yom doesn't mean once a day, it means a few times a day. Moreover, even after Esther was taken away and appointed the queen, Mordechai stayed there. What for? What was he doing there? Well, Mordechai Yoshev Bishara Melech, according to Chazal, Mordechai was a member of the Sanhedrin. Why didn't he just go home? And why did Mordechai forbid Esther from revealing her identity? The answer lies between the lines of the Megillah. Is that somehow a mood of tense expectancy, of concentrated anticipation, permeated Mordechai. If you read the whole story, this mood of tenseness, anticipation, foreboding, of not knowing what kind of events will occur, pervades the whole background. Apparently Mordechai didn't regard the coercive removal of Esther from his home and her ascent to the queenship of Persia as a trivial episode. It wasn't trivial to him. He could have interpreted in very simple terms, namely that Ahasuerus was on the lookout for a beautiful wife, and Esther was just that, met his criteria. Any other Mordechai would have interpreted such an event rationally, practically, businesslike. Apparently Mordechai wasn't a businessman. His mind wasn't guided by commercial logic. He realized that this event, that Esther, a Jewish girl, a refugee, should become the queen of Persia, cannot be explained in simple terms. This is, Hashem is behind this. We Jews believe that there's a maker of history. History doesn't make itself. Someone directs the destiny of history. Mordechai recognized the fingerprints of the maker of history, planning, preparing, and setting the stage for an unfolding of a great, breathtaking drama. He didn't know what would be, but he knew something big would be. That's what we call an alertness to history, a sensitivity to events. Some people are dull to historical events. Many Jews came to the United States in the late 1800s, early 1900s. If they understood history well, then we wouldn't have lost two generations. If they would have changed their approach to chinuch, we would have had the greatest and most beautiful Jewish community that ever existed. But unlike Mordechai, they weren't alert to history. They considered each event as ordinary and didn't give their children a Jewish education. Mordechai had historical perception. Mordechai believed something else. Mordechai knew that the history is the story of man, not that of the astral world. History is the story of the human world. The latter has a right and is duty-bound to intervene in historical unfolding and to direct events towards those objectives which he cherishes. In the opinion of the Torah, man is free, and this freedom is part of the greater freedom which is granted to man by his Maker. Man is free to play an important part in shaping his historical drama. He can change events. He can channel events towards different objectives. Mordechai believed that if man is duty-bound to intervene in the historical process, and man is capable of leaving an imprint on an historical unfolding, then man must not miss the opportunity. And the opportunity is almost infinitesimal. We all know the story of Shirashirim, of the Shulamit. Shulamit's a peculiar girl. Sometimes her actions are so paradoxical, it's hard to understand her. She was out to find her beloved, her dod. She constantly searched day and night. She exposed herself to injury, humiliation, abuse. Mitzauni ashomrim asovavim ba'ir, hikuni ptzauni nasus rididim me'alai. She keeps looking. One night she comes home late, tired, exhausted. She undresses and goes to bed. It's a dark night, a dreary night. Suddenly she hears a knock on the door. Who is it? Open the door for me, my sister, my love, my beloved. My head is full of dew. What was she supposed to do? She keeps searching for him. What does she say? No, Pashati eskutanti echal b'shena. I already undressed. How can I put on my clothes again? Rachatzti esragla echal tanfe. I already washed my feet. How could I dirty them by touching the ground? Her beloved knocks once, twice, three, four times, finally stops knocking. Then she jumps off her bed, opens the gate to allow him in. But by then he's gone. Many people play the same role vis-a-vis history. They want something, they search for something. Then when it happens, we become lazy. Mordechai wasn't lazy. He waited at the gate. A lack of historical sensibility and alertness resulted in the Versailles Treaty. Even though some of the people who wrote the treaty were great statesmen of international renown, such as Lord George and Woodrow Wilson, nonetheless they had written a different treaty. Had they written a different treaty, Hitler wouldn't have emerged on the historical arena and 20 million lives could have been saved. They divided Germany into two parts. They separated East Prussia from Western Germany, similar to the way it's presently divided. Whoever crossed this corridor and locked their doors to protect themselves from the fractious Polish soldiers. One could feel that another war was in the rising. The Versailles Treaty was directly responsible for the Second World War. Similarly, the Yalta Treaty, which was blessed by President Roosevelt, also was terrible. If not for the Yalta Treaty, there wouldn't have been such a big problem with Berlin, with Czechoslovakia, and others. It was a lack of alertness, of understanding history, of clairvoyance, of vision. That's what Mordechai had, but which many of the great statesmen of the 20th century lacked. So, there is more to say. This is only part of the talk, and Mir Tashem, I hope that will be zelcha to continue and learn so much about history in our lives from Purim, what Purim teaches us about history and what history teaches us about Purim. So thank you so much for listening, and Mir Tashem B'li Neder, I hope to be zelcha to continue. Please stay tuned for more. Shalom, shalom.